Well, we've got a good crowd again tonight. We appreciate that so much. Whether you intended to or not, you're helping me and encouraging me and encouraging everybody else simply by your presence. It says a lot about who you are to come at a time like this and to spend time studying the Bible and trying to see what God wants us to be. We're going to look at this book in the third chapter of Ecclesiastes, the old king years ago who spoke a different language and was a very rich man, lived in a different land. And yet what he has to say is something, it seems to me, that he learned, and I think that he probably wrote in his old age to demonstrate that he had really learned what life was about and had repented of a lot of the mistakes that he made when he was a younger person. And so when we look at this third chapter, he takes us now to a direction that helps us to think about something that we all know about, that is time. Time is sometimes seems like a box we're caught in. We're locked into this thing called time. There are these seasons and parts of life. We can't change the time we're living in. We can't escape it, run from it, or advance it. Nobody gets to the Beatles sang a song 8 days a week. I've not found one yet. And nobody gets 25 hours in a day. And so we understand that Horace Mann wrote years ago and said period of a day's time between sunrise and sunset, there are 12 golden hours set with 60 diamond minutes. They're lost forever and no reward is offered. You know, we can throw away a day if we're not careful. And Ephesians 5 and verse 15 tells us that we're to redeem the time and not to waste the time, buy up the time, do good with our time. And so we're not going to get any extra time. And when our time, our space here is finished, that's going to be the end of it. And so Solomon is going to write to us, help us to understand something about our limitation when we look at time. We could go and look at Deuteronomy 30 and see where there Moses appealed to the people about this day, God is saying something. This day, Moses is trying to appeal to the people to think about right now, this is the time, this moment right now is the time to think about your life, how you're living, what you're doing, and make up your mind to choose a life and not choose death, and to make up your mind to serve God and not serve yourself or serve some idol or something else. And so right now, at this time, you see, it's a critical moment. God's given us by His providence this opportunity, and so we ought to make the best of it. When you look at the 90th Psalm, a psalm written by Moses, and when Moses wrote about that psalm, he said there that God teach us to number our days and to realize that we're like a shadow. We come along and we look at how God sees a thousand years as a day and a shadow spinning a day. It just passes away. And here we come along, we're just a shadow, we're just like a hand's breadth before God. We're small and insignificant, like flower grows up in the morning and evening it's cut out, it withers away. And so Moses wanted us to learn to start thinking about our days and doing good with them and realizing my days are numbered, so I better do something good with my days. Now listen to what Solomon says about that in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 1. To every time there is a season. That word season means a fitted time. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to get and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to rent and a time to sow. A time to keep silent. I wish some people could learn that. And a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time of war and a time of peace. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? And so the writer's saying here, since we know now we've got all these times, and notice there are 14 periods of time listed here, and we look at them and we see them, some we would say seven of them look like they're positive and seven look like they're negative. And so we would look at that. So if you take seven positives and say seven negatives and you add them up together, you end up with a big zero, you see. And so here are these couplets put together showing us that really when we think something is adverse, maybe something is adverse is really good. Maybe it's not something bad at all. And so we see all these things put together. We can see in 2 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, And in verse 7, the Apostle Paul showed how that the thorn in the flesh was given to him may have looked like an adversity, but it really made him humble because of all the revelation had been given to him. And so what might have seemed adverse sometime to him or adverse to us can sometimes be the greatest grace and the greatest mercy that God can give to us. And so as we look at these principles here that are stated about time and look at what the writer says about everything to God, God, everything is beautiful as time. I want you to think about when you look at verse 11, when he says there, well, verse 10, when he says, I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has set the world in their heart so that no man can find out the work that God doeth from the beginning to the end. I want you to look in this verse and see how that, first of all, what God tells us is that what God has done, he's exercising us. He's trying to test us and develop us by making all these seasons of time that you go through. I don't know what season of time you might be going through, but you think about the seasons themselves. What if I were to say, well, this Christmas, I'm going to put out a garden this Christmas down in Indiana, and I'm going to get some dynamite and bust the frozen ground up and stomp around on it and break the clods up, and I'm going to plant me a garden in December. What would I do? What benefit would it do me to plant a garden in December? You see, when you work against the seasons that are in life, you're hurting yourself, you're killing yourself, you're fighting against the system. And so what you need to learn in life, as you go along life, there are going to be things that are going to rise. There are going to be issues that are going to develop in your life. Periods of time are going to come. Fit times for life, and you've got to go through those times, and you cannot escape them. You can't run away from them, and you can't avoid them. And so the writer is just showing us here the harmony that all of this system of time, all these systems, God has put them all together, and what we need to realize is we cannot change them at all. We can't change that. We can't run away from it. We can't alter it in any way. And so the writer helps us to see that what we need to understand about that is God is testing or exercising us as we live in these times. And he says in verse 11 that he hath made everything beautiful in its time. Now think about that. When everything comes in the right time and is dealt with in the right time, it's a beautiful thing. I've learned in my lifetime when there's some issue with people or something happening, I learned to wait and not get in a hasty because I know generally my turn and my time is going to come. Rather than jumping on that and trying to do something in a hurry and settle it in my way, I just kind of wait a while and let that work, and I wait till somebody will say something to me or some opportunity will come. Somebody might come ask me something. And so then the door's open for me in that season to do exactly what I need to do, and it teaches me patience. It teaches me to wait on God, teaching me to trust in God. So everything, when it's done in the right season, is beautiful. I learned that about when I would come home from work, when I worked in National Harvester for 8 years, when I first obeyed the gospel, my wife and I lived in Louisville. And I learned that when I came home from work, if I came in the house and my wife started telling me that the commode was overflowing and the dishwasher had broke down and I'd just come in from a hard day's work, it was not the right season to start talking to me about that. I needed to get a hamburger in my stomach and a cold drink and kind of rest for a minute or two. And so when she would wait till that time came, then I was ready to get up and start doing some other things. But life's not a way, you see. And if you can learn to look at life, realize that there's a season for everything, and you start watching. You start, there's a fitted time for everything. And if you can learn there's a fitted time, I've known a preacher friend of mine who his wife died, and he told me while he was at the coffin, a young boy came up to him and started fussing him about wanting to have a debate with him about some issue, something he had said some time ago, and just kept going on, and it stopped the whole procession, and this fellow just got so distraught he didn't know what to do. That was the wrong season, the wrong time to do something like that. So we need to learn there's a right time and a right season for everything, and God says everything is beautiful when you do it in its right season. I would say that's true about getting married. You know, if you wait till you're ready to get married and you find somebody that loves the Lord, then there's the season, and you ought to get married. That's beautiful in its time. But now if you some young teenager and just get excited about somebody and you want to get married and quit school and do all that, you've picked the wrong season for something like that. This is a lifelong thing you're thinking about. So when you think about in everything you do, look at your life, where you are, what you're doing, and realize there's seasons for everything. And so when you think about what that says, we need to ask ourselves sometimes, does anybody know what time it is? Do you know what the season is? And look at that with raising children or in your marriage. You know, I've said about my wife, when we first took our oldest son off to college, we went down to Florida, and somebody had given me and her some tickets to go over to that Disney World down there. And so we drove down there, and my son was like, well, Mom, are y'all going to do something, change my room and put my stuff out of my room? And she said, no, honey, you can come back home when the break's coming. When school's out, you can come back home. And he said, well, Mommy, I just wonder, y'all going to come see me? Mom? And so he just kept saying things that made Diane, her heart was broken, and she was troubled. And so when we dropped him off at school and got him settled in, she went in there and fixed his room up, got it all made nice. She came out and got in the car. I said, okay, baby girl, now we're ready to go over to Disney World. She said, take me home. I don't want to go anywhere. Well, you see, there was a season for that, you see. Now, we took the second boy to college, and she'd already gotten used to that. We got down there and dropped Scott off. He disappeared. We didn't see him anymore. He didn't even say goodbye to us, you know. And we could have went to Disney World the second time. But I want you to see that that's the way life is. There are seasons, and you have to learn. And I've learned about my wife. I can remember when she was younger, I worked hard studying her, and it's what you need to do. And I kind of learned what she wanted, what she liked. But as time went on then, I would do some of those things I'd learned years ago, and I found she didn't like that anymore. She had changed. The season had changed in her life. Things were different for her, you see. So what you've got to do in life is learn that everything is beautiful. That's what God says. If you can learn to look at the seasons in life and see that God's made everything beautiful in its season, and just wait for the season, look for it, trust God and wait on the system of God, and realize if you balk the system and plant your garden in December, you're just killing yourself. You're not going to eat that garden, and you're not going to benefit from it because you didn't know that there are seasons for everything in life. But notice something else about this verse. He says also, not only is everything beautiful in its time, also he has set the world in their hearts. Now this word, if you have another translation, the English version, or the other translations of this, you'll find that it says, he has put eternity in their heart. Now what does that say? That says that God has made us, he's made us, we're going to see we're common to animals in some way, but there's some ways we're not common to animals at all. And one thing is, we have inside of us the desire and the ambition to look and to see and to study and to understand the value, the fact that there might be something beyond us here in this world, somebody out there beyond us, you see. And that somebody may have made all of us and created. And so we have, now animals don't think about that, but an individual who may not have ever read the Bible. I've met people who've never seen a Bible, never heard about the Lord, and meet them and tell me, they said, you know, I heard y'all were coming, and I just know there's got to be somebody behind all this. It just couldn't have happened this way. And so there are people who understand just by living in the world, the order and the design, the things they see, they know there has got to be something beyond this. They know there's a summit somewhere out there. And we're not at the summit yet. But there's something out there at the top and the peak, and it's what the Bible calls eternity. I was reading about two astrologers who were studying the stars through a radio telescope. One of them was an atheist, one of them was a Christian. And this atheist looked out through the stars and said, you know, when you look out at all the vastness of the universe, you can see that we're not made by God. We are so small and we are so insignificant. How could anybody think that we could be made by God by looking at the vastness of what's here and think that we're something important in the universe? Well, the Christian said, well, you might be mistaken about that. And he said, well, how's that? He said, God has made us to be astrologers. We can look at the stars. We can wonder about the extents of what's out there and how it came about and the marvel how it keeps extending and how we can't see the end of it. No, there's got to be something about all this. So you see, when we look at the fact, what we need to understand about life is that God has put something inside of every person. It's a desire to want to know. Want to know about death, what's after death, and to think about the fact that death really kind of brings you back to your perspective. And so the writer is showing us here that when God has made everything beautiful in his time, he set the world in their heart. And now why has he done that? The Bible says, so that a man cannot find out the work that God doeth from the beginning to the end. So why did God do all that? God did all that, good people, so you would learn your limitations. You know you're limited. We get to thinking we are so smart, you know. Oh, we're just the smartest people in the world. I don't need God to tell me anything. I don't believe there's any God. We're so smart, we know. Well, look how much smarter we are today than they were back in the old stupid 60s, you know, back when people were back in those days. And so we just think we've got it all figured, and we fail to realize there's an enigma in life. And the enigma is that God is in control and God is governing things. And my friend, your little bitty old finite mind cannot understand or begin to imagine to measure the infinite God who made us all. And so that's why God did it. So you would realize you've got to trust God. You've got to rely upon God because you, my friend, are limited. You don't know everything. You might think you do, but I'll tell you, there's a whole universe you don't know about. And so when we see that God did it so, we would understand that there's an enigma that we can't figure out. It's what God is doing. We don't know what He's up to. I don't know what God's doing right now with America. I have some idea, but I'm not sure what God is doing. I don't know what God is doing in my life, doing the life of my children. But I'll tell you one thing. I know God has begun a work, Philippians 1 says, and God is not going to finish it, not going to quit in verse 5. So God's working. He's doing something. I can't put my fingers. I know God's doing this and God's doing that, but I know God's doing things. And so the writer says, when we think about the fact that we are limited when we look at what God has done, we know there's a summit out there, we know there's eternity, there's something beyond us, something resting outside of us. It's not just us that's here, we're just here, somebody that's in a shale by ourselves. There's somebody living inside of the shale. And so that makes me know that there's something about who we are. And then notice he says in verse 12, I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labor. It is the gift of God. And notice we're right back to this again. So what do? We worry about life. We're troubled and bothered. Jesus, the only time the Bible says anything about tomorrow, Jesus said, don't worry about tomorrow. That's the one thing we worry about. But when you think about the fact that what we ought to do is not worry about life, don't be frustrated about the things we can't understand, we don't know what God is up to, all we need to do is just take what God gives us every day. God is giving you what you have every day, and God wants you to take this gift and enjoy it every day. So don't lay in a bed and worry all night. Don't be troubled and bothered about life. Don't be afraid of life. Just realize, just go on and enjoy it today. Make the best out of day. Carpe diem, is that what the phrase is about? Conquer, seize the day, make the best out of it today. If we could just get involved in trying to seize this day, I tell people when I wake up in the morning, I say, God, I'm going to try to make this my best day. And I get up in the morning with that attitude, trying to say, I'm going to see what I can do to make this my best day. I'm going to study and write some of my best sermons, or if I can do that, and just try to make the best out of this day. And when I get to the end of the day, I think, well, you know, I didn't do as well as I'd like to have done, but tomorrow I'm going to make that a better day. And if you get up every morning and you think about that and think that way, what you're going to find out is your days are going to get better. You're going to get more involved in your life, more thinking about people, thinking about God, doing better things, because you're making this day the best day. And what you'll find out is your life will just, it will become opened up to all sorts of opportunities if you do that. And so here's a picture of God wanting us every day to enjoy life. And then notice in verse 14, he says, I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it. Now listen to this. That men should fear before God. You know, there's an O in this old translation I've got where the Old Testament calls God an awful God. God is a terrible God. That word awful is a Hebrew, I can't remember what those words are when you have words that stand for something else. But it's like when I was back in the 60s, we had a car to go by, we said, there goes a bad car. Well, we meant that's a fine car, is what we meant, see. We had this colloquialism. We had a colloquialism, a phrase that really did mean what we said. And when you think about all full, what does that mean? All, standing all of something. See the marvel, the amazement of it. And so we should be all filled with God when we look at the greatness of God. And when we look at what we see in the world and what we can't understand what we ought to do, since we can't figure it out, we just need to respect God and reverence God. That's what we ought to do. That's why God made it this way. So we realize, I can't control this thing. I'm locked in this box of time. I can't move away from it. I can't speed up. I can't slow it down. And so what I need to do is just trust God all the time. And just keep looking to the summit. Trying to find my way every day of my life to see what God says. Don't let life weary you. Don't let it beat you down. Don't get depressed over life. Don't become discouraged. Don't want to give up and quit on life. Every day, find some good in it and enjoy the good that is in that day. And then he says this about that in verse 15. That which hath been is now, and that which is to come, which hath been already, and God requiteth that which is past. Notice, here's a picture of what God has put things in place. God has made things the way they are, and you can't change that. You know, you might think, well, I'll just violate some of God's law. I won't obey the gospel. It won't hurt me. Okay, once you violate another law, get on top of the building, run off the edge of it, jump off the building, and violate the law of nature. See if that'll hurt you. Maybe you'll find out what not obeying the gospel will do to you. But when you see God has made laws and put things in place, and you can't change them, you can't alter them, you just need to do what God says. And when you understand that why God did all that is so that we could see that everything is important to God. God, don't you see, is going to require that which is past. You know that God's going to make everything right one day? Sometimes people aggravate and bother me, and sometimes I want to take that in my own hands and take my sword out and whittle on them a little bit, you know, and talk gospel about somebody or something. And I realize, you know, I just need to let that alone, and I need to give that to God and realize that God can do a much better job of straightening things out than I can. So I'll just let God. He cares about all that. He's watching. He's observing. And He is going to require what is in the past. So that means God cares about everything. Don't think, well, God doesn't care about it. Yes, God does. God cares about who we are, what we're doing, what happens to us, how people treat us, how we treat other people. And so God is going to require that of people who live in the world. Now notice in verse 16, the writer turns now to show us after everything matters to God, he says some things that are that all of us struggle with. He's going to show this quite a bit in this book. And moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment, that wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. Now think about this. Here's an old boy says, you know what, I'm going to go to court. Now when you go to court, what you're going to find is you're going to get justice in the court. My wife was driving into a gospel meeting several years ago, and we were riding in this little blue car that we had, and a Corvette Stingray came flying by us on the interstate. He must have been doing 85, 90 miles an hour, swerved over in front of us and went off the interstate on a ramp and got off. We went up to the next ramp and pulled over. That Stingray was the same color as our car. We pulled up to the next exit and the police pulled us over. Policeman got out all mad and said, you all been doing 90 miles an hour. My wife said, no, sir, I had my cruise control on. And I said, no, sir. He said, your equipment's broke. I saw you, I spotted you doing 90 miles an hour now. I'm going to give you a ticket. And so I thought, well, okay, just let's hush up, baby. We'll go to court and it'll all be worked out. No. We had to pay a terrible fine. And it would have cost us a lot more time, a lot more energy to keep going to court, going. We had to go. If we were going to fight it, we had to keep going and doing all sorts of things. And so my wife had to be taken off work and cost a lot of money. It was cheaper just pay the fine and go on, let it be. But I want you to see, you ever think, well, surely if you go to court, oh, you're going to get everything. No, wickedness is in the courtroom. Well, now, okay, I know where you can find justice. Go to the meeting house. Go to the church building. Oh, when my wife and I obeyed the gospel, we thought Christians were perfect people. They would never do anything wrong. They wouldn't hurt anybody. That's all. Christians are so wonderful. And so we came into this thing blind, you know, and we got blindsided pretty quick. We learned that, no, you can go to the church building and you can find out. I'm going to tell you what, some bad things can happen at the meeting house. And some people can misbehave and can mishandle you and can hurt you and you can get discouraged if you're not careful. And so the writer says, let me tell you, do you see all this stuff in the world, all the unfairness, injustice? I remember my sons when they were younger. John was older, of course, and John and Scott would do something. Well, I'd tell John, I'd talk to John about it, and I would give John 5 licks with my hand. And then I'd talk to Scott, and I'd give him 3 licks. And John said, Dad, the world, that's not fair. Now, we did the same thing, and he got 3. I said, well, son, you're 2 years older. I said, you want me to put you living under the rules that he lives in? I said, he can't go down the street and see his friends. He has to stay in the yard because he's younger than you. You want to have to stay in the backyard with him? He said, no. I said, well, he don't think that's fair, to stay in the yard because he's younger. But I said, don't you see that life is not fair? I said, get on the bus with everybody else. Life is not fair. And so don't get excited when you see that life's not fair. That's the way life is. And so the writer goes on to say to us, after he tells us about that obvious thing that we all see and know that frustrates us, he then says in verse 17, and I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every purpose and for every work. So notice now, there's a time to make everything right. And don't you worry, God's going to make it all right. He's going to set the record straight. He's going to make things right that were done wrong. And so don't you worry a bit about it. There's a time for it, but let me tell you, the time is not today. And I'm glad it's not today. If God were to push the button today and say today is the end, my mama would not go to heaven. I keep hoping I'm going to be able to convince my mama to do what is right. But if it were to end today, my mama would be lost. I don't want my mama to be lost. There are people I'm talking to and studying with, people I love, people who are coming to church, and they seem to be excited, but they haven't obeyed the gospel. I don't want God to end it yet. I can see why God would wait. He's waiting. His long suffering is because He is desirous of salvation for people. And so that's why God's waiting. He's waiting on us to get busy and teach people and for people to obey the gospel so they can go to heaven. And so here's a picture, don't you see, of one day God is going to end it all. There's going to be a judgment, but it's not today. And so don't you think, well, we better get it all straight today because I'm sick and tired of this mess and I want it all straight. Give up on that. It's not going to happen. There's going to always be something. I used to try to go along and straighten things out when people would bother me and cause trouble. People sometime at church would want to gossip. They'd call me, want to gossip about somebody. And I would pick the phone up. I'd say, okay. I said, hello. They said, I want to tell you something about so-and-so. I said, yeah. I said, just a minute. They said, wait a minute. I said, I got to get me a pencil, piece of paper. They said, why? I said, I'm going to write down everything you say. Write your name at the top of the paper, write everything you say. And I'm going to call the person up when you get done talking and talk to him about what you said. They said, well, listen, I got to go. I can't talk to you right now. But, you see, but there are going to be people who do things like that. And you just have to learn that that's not the way. But there are going to be people who get behind your back and stab you and do things. Don't let that get under your skin. Don't you get upset at somebody. Can you love your enemy and those that persecute you? God does. Well, if you're going to be God's child, God's son or God's daughter, why don't you do what God does? Just love them and go on about that. And so notice he then says to us in verse 18, I said in my heart concerning the estate of the sons of men that God might manifest or prove or test or expose them that they might see that they themselves are beasts. Now notice, he's going to say something seems strange to us here. To look at how that we are like beasts here. Now what does he mean about that? Have you ever thought about the unfairness in the kingdom of beasts? Have you ever watched an alligator jump up and grab a young fawn on the edge of a water brook and start tearing that little fawn in two, tearing his legs off, tearing him up, or a lion jumping on the back of a giraffe and starting to chew his head off? And you think, well, that just doesn't seem fair to me. And you think about the fact that when it rains on the animals, and guess what else? It rains on me too when I'm out there. And when animals get hungry, you know, they got to get out and they got to hustle around and get something to eat. The only difference between me and animals when it comes to getting time to eat is animals don't have any welfare. They got to get out, they want to eat, and they got to get it. And so here's a picture of how there's common things with us and animals. We're like animals in a lot of ways. We share this world being the creatures of God in this world that God has made. And so he says, here's some places where we can see it with injustice, but what about some other things? He says in verse 19, for that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them, as one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they all have one breath, so that man hath no preeminence, so that is no advantage over the beast, for all is vanity. So here's a picture of animals breathing and we breathing. And you know what happens? We all die. And guess what happens to our bodies? Our body goes into the tomb and it dies. And matter of fact, he's going to say here in the next verse, in verse 20, he says, all go to one place and all are of dust and all turn to dust again. So you know what life is about? It's a fight about dust all the way through. My wife's always dusting in the house, fighting the dust. Guess what? We came from the dust. We're going to go back to the dust. Animals came from the dust. They're going to go back to the dust, you see. Here's a picture of all of us as we're like the animals. When we're all going to die. We're going to be dust. Have you thought about the fact that the mortality rate is 100%? Everybody's going to die. Every person who comes in the world is going to die. That's the way that is. And so here's a picture of us understanding that the grave and animals and the injustice in the world. So we're like animals. We're not God. We're more like the animals than we are like God. We're creatures of God, you see. The only difference is we have the ability because we have the stamp of God on us because we're made in His image. We know we have the ability to reason. There's a God. Animals don't do that. So there's the big difference. And notice he brings that to the forefront in the next verse. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward or the spirit of beast that goeth downward to the earth? Now, you know, when you get to the 12th chapter in verse 7, you know what he's going to tell us? We know that the spirit of man goes up to God who gave it. When man dies, his body goes to the dust, and his spirit goes up to God. So see, you want to know who knows? We know, and God knows. But you know what he's saying? If you're living under the sun and somebody dies, can you see a spirit going up somewhere? Well, there he went. Oh, no, he went down that way. No, you don't see that. You don't know. When an animal dies, you don't see a spirit going up or coming down. So you know when you just live under the sun, you can't see that there's something happening that is really significant when a human being dies and the way they've lived and where they go. And so the writer helps us see in the next verse, in verse 20 and verse 22, he says, wherefore, here's the conclusion now, I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his works, for that is his portion, for who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? And so here's just a picture of the fact of the matter is that when we get finished here, what's going to happen is we're here to enjoy this and to do what God wants us to do now, and the end's going to come, and we're not going to be able to come back and look at this again. We've only got one shot at it, one life at it. And you know, we've only got one opportunity to get there, and this book is showing that there's a lot of adversity and problems in the process. And I tell people, you know something to learn about that? Did you ever thought about the destination is much more significant than the mode of travel? And let me explain what I'm trying to say to you. Several years ago, I was in Zimbabwe up in Victoria Falls, and I decided I was getting ready to go home. And so I decided I would punch my stopwatch and see how long it would take me to get home. So I punched my watch. And I got on a train and went down from Victoria Falls down to Bulawayo. It took 13 hours to go down there. But what happened that night, we were down, they call the trains there the roach coaches, because when you go to sleep, bugs get in your mouth and get all over you. But anyway, we were riding the roach coach, and the driver went to sleep, the train driver, and so there's a mountain range in the middle of the country. Well, he didn't have enough speed to get up over the mountaintop, so we got halfway up and we couldn't go. So we had to back up and go an hour back up where we had come from and start again. So it took us 15 hours to go what took 13 hours to get up there. So I got down to Bulawayo. I got in a little ox cart and got my stuff, went over to a road where I catch a cab, got in the cab, went over to the airport, and I got on an airplane. I flew to Brussels, Belgium. I sat up there all night through the night, and then I flew over to Chicago, or I think it was New York City, and then finally I flew down to Indianapolis, and then my wife drove up there 2 hours and picked me up, and I got home. 56 hours to get home. But what if somebody would have come to me and said, "Now, Gary, listen to me. What we're going to do is we're going to give you a flight on the French Air. We're going to fly up in the outer atmosphere at a Mach 2. We're going to fly you home in a couple of hours. You can eat a steak dinner and watch a movie on the way. And when we get there, we're going to fly it in there. But what we're going to do is we're not going to land. We're going to take an easy flight, an enjoyable flight, but we're not going to land there. We're going to fly around over the top of Indiana, let you look down and see Madison until we've run out of gas, and we're going to crash and burn. And so which way you want to go, Gary? You want the easy flight that takes you home and you eat a steak dinner, watch me, or do you want to take the old ox cart roach coach ride? Which way you want to go? Let me tell you, going to heaven and getting into the presence of God is going to be an arduous task. It's going to wear the hide off of you. You're going to get frustrated and aggravated. You're sometimes going to wonder, can I do it? Or maybe I'll just quit. Can you see the writer saying in the world we're living in? Sometimes it looks like an animal kingdom, the way we treat each other, the way people treat each other. Just devour each other and try to take the life from each other. If we can see, good people, that getting home, destination is what really matters. It doesn't matter what you've got to go through to get home. You just make sure you get home. God's made all the provisions. You can come tonight if you've obeyed the gospel. You can come with a confession on your mouth. The greatest thing you'll ever say with your mouth is that you believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. That means He's the King of your life and the Lord of everything in your life. You can come make that confession tonight. And if He's your Lord, He'll have to be your master. And you'll have to do what He says. He said, go. He told the disciples to go and preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. You can come this afternoon and you can do that. You can come and you can be baptized if you believe. And your sins will be forgiven. If you believe the gospel and you're willing to be baptized, your sins can be washed away. If you're here tonight and need to respond anyway to the gospel, why don't you come while we stand and sing the song of encouragement.